This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the fourth installment of this mini medical school series. Thank you for quieting down. And it is my pleasure to welcome you back. I encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. You have been doing very well. You are a great audience to work with. And we are going to enjoy the topic of genetics in tonight's lecture and next week. And we are lucky to have with us the expert in genetics education here at UCSF. She's responsible for all the genetics education in our for our medical students, giving a lot of the lectures and coordinating all the teachers, incorporating all the expertise here on campus. So just to briefly recap Dr. Hyland's biography, she is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics, also a member of the Institute of Human Genetics here at UCSF. She did her graduate work at Johns Hopkins, getting into genetics early on. Then did a postdoc in British Columbia, then saw the light and came to do a second postdoc here at UCSF, which is where we became colleagues. We both then went into education. Dr. Hyland developed the medical curriculum in genetics for the medical students here at UCSF and has since then expanded her roles at UCSF, including faculty development, helping other people teach or helping other people improve their teaching, and has been expanding that even beyond UCSF and beyond the United States. So we're very excited to have her here with us in this course. And I would like you to join me in welcoming Dr. Hyland.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's a very warm welcome. Thank you for coming out on this wet evening. It's really great to see you all here, and it's really a privilege to be here with all you inquiring minds. It's really fantastic. We're just so pleased that so many of you are interested in finding out more about what we do here at UCSF at our medical school. So, as Marika said, tonight we're going to focus on genetics this week and next week. But I first want to link back to the very first lecture in this series that Dr. Gundling gave 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, on immunology. That was the first session on immunology. And she introduced a patient of hers, Elizabeth, who has common variable immune deficiency, or CVID. And to remind you, CVID is kind of an umbrella diagnosis for late onset humoral immune deficiency. And there are many different causes that, or different things that can cause this humoral immune deficiency. And Dr. Gundling talked a bit about that and about that type of immunity. Well, it turns out that a significant fraction of patients with CVID have a genetic cause. And of those with a genetic cause, some are due to a single gene defect and some are due to multiple genes. So this is called heterogeneous, which means that there are multiple genes involved. In different people, there might be different genes, different genetic defects in different families. So we're going to talk a bit more about that later today and next week. Now, there are also about 75 to 80% of cases where the cause is not known. However, genetics is likely to play a role. And I'm going to talk about a bit how genetics can play a role and what level genetics plays a role in different types of diseases. So looking at the genetics of CVID, about 10 to 20% of cases, there is a known genetic cause. And in fact, five different genes have been identified with mutations that lead to this disease. And as I said, there's about 80% when we don't know the cause. And actually, where are all the high school students? Can you guys raise your hand so I can see where you are? Okay, you're all scattered around. Excellent. So my charge to you guys, as you continue on to college and grad school or med school or wherever you end up, is maybe you can find some of these genes and some of the causes of the other 80% that we don't know yet. So some of these cases in which the 10 to 20% where there is a known genetic defect, some of those cases are inherited in what's called an autosomal dominant fashion, and some are inherited in what's called an autosomal recessive fashion. And we're going to talk more about the inheritance patterns next week. Are you guys from high school, are you familiar with these inheritance patterns? Do you know autosomal recessive and dominant? Yes? Excellent. Okay, so we'll come back to that. Now, in addition to, so there's five different genes, and within those genes, there are different mutations in different families. So this is what's called, when I mentioned heterogeneous. Heterogeneous means that there are different genes, as well as there can be different mutations in the different genes. So we're going to talk about the different types of mutations later today, and inheritance patterns more next time. So with this kind of introduction and linking back to CVID, I now want to just let you know what we're going to cover today and then what we're going to cover next week. So I'll give you a bit of an overview of the genetic contribution to human disease, and then we're going to look at the basic principles of genetics, so everybody's on the same page, and look at some, define some of the terminology, and look at the structure and function of the human genome. And then lastly, we'll look at genetic variation and look at mutation versus polymorphism and different types of genetic variants. And then next week, we will look at how genetic diseases or any trait that is inherited, how they are inherited, the different patterns of inheritance and how we follow those patterns of inheritance. And then we're going to talk a bit about genetic testing and some of the methods that are used to look at the different genetic variants that are inherited, be they at a single gene level, a chromosome, or a whole genome level. And I'll also touch on some direct-to-consumer testing that is available. So our learning goals for today are, first, that I want, by the end of this session, I hope that you all will be able to describe how genetics contributes to human disease. And I hope that you all understand and can use the basic genetic terminology, and that you'll be able to describe the basic organization of the human genome, and as well describe the types of variation that are seen in the human genome and the potential phenotypic consequences. And I'll be defining a lot of these things as we continue on. So first of all, I want to think about the genetic contribution to disease. Okay? So if you think about the spectrum of different kinds of diseases. There are some diseases that genetics plays a very big role, and some diseases where it plays a smaller role in combination with environmental factors. So virtually all human disease has some level of genetic component, right? So as I said, there are some, down here at this end of the spectrum, there are some diseases that are mainly due to genetics. And for example, something like cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease or Down syndrome. If you have the mutation, if you have the defect, you have this disease. Okay? There are variations of the disease and a lot of variability within that, but if you have these mutations, you get that disease. At the other end of the spectrum down here are diseases that are mainly due to environmental factors. Okay? Something like an infectious disease like the measles or lung cancer due to cigarette smoke, some environmental insult. In between these two ends of the spectrum lie the vast majority of human diseases. And these are called multifactorial because there are multiple factors that are involved that lead to these diseases. Okay, so there may be multiple genes and multiple genetic factors that in combination will lead to these diseases. And because there's multiple genes and multiple environmental factors, there is a lot of variability in these diseases. And I'm talking about diabetes, stroke, hypertension, Alzheimer's disease, many, many others that we could all name. Now, CVID, I've put down here in two places. So CVID, there are examples. As I said, there are those that are inherited in autosomal dominant or autosomal recessive fashion, and those are due to a specific mutation. If you have that mutation, you get that disease. There are also forms of CVID that are more heterogeneous and more multifactorial in nature that are due to a combination of genes and environment, and we haven't really figured that all out yet. Okay. So these down here, these diseases that are due to mainly to a genetic cause, these genetic defects are more rare in the population, whereas those that are involved in the more common diseases are more common in the population. And these variants are often called susceptibility variants. So in and of itself, those genetic changes might not lead to disease directly, but they give you a susceptibility to disease. And it depends on your environment and other factors, your lifestyle, whether you actually come down with that disease or not. Okay? But genetics can play a big role in laying down susceptibility or resistance to different diseases. So thinking about that virtually all disease has some level of genetic component, I like to impress upon the medical students to think of every patient they see as an individual. And it's useful in order to do that to look at genetics or look at medicine through a genetics lens. And this is a mantra that I learned from a mentor back at Hopkins when I was a student, and I like to pass this on to my students here. So I like to say when you're meeting a patient, to think about why is this person here in my office? Why this person? And why are they affected with this particular disease, this complaint, whatever it is? Why are they here? Why are they affected with that particular ailment? And why now? Why at this point in their life? What contributed to this for them to present with this disease at this point? And then we want to think about what the very important part of how to restore that person to their own unique steady state or their own unique state of health. Okay. So with that overview of just thinking about medical genetics, I want to kind of step back and look at the framework or provide a framework of the basic principles of genetics. And we're going to find some terminology, kind of go through the ABCs of genes and genomes. So DNA, genes, a locus, allele, genome, chromosome, we're going to define all these terms. So first of all, as many of you probably are very familiar with this analogy of the human genome, if you think about a book. So the letters in the book are like the DNA. Okay, the DNA is like the individual letters, and when you put those letters together, they form words. Right? Now, those letters can come together in certain ways that make sense to us, that form a word that makes sense, or those letters can come together in ways that don't make sense. Right? So the genes are the words, the ones that make sense. And then if we put all the words together into paragraphs, and maybe there's some pictures or some other things in between there, and then we have chapters, those chapters are equivalent to what we call chromosomes. And then the entire book is like the human genome. So that's the manual for creating a living being. Now, what do we have in common with every other living thing on Earth? DNA. We all have DNA in common, right? That's something that really joins us all together, all living beings. And DNA, to remind you, is composed of four basic elements: adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. These are the four bases that make up DNA, as shown here. Adenine always binds with thymine and cytosine with guanine. These form base pairs. I'm going to show you the structure in just a moment. And these are the basic letters that make up the entire human genome. So simple and yet so complex, right? I mean, it's really quite remarkable if you think about it that each of us, look around the room, right? How similar we are, that we are all human beings. We all have a lot of basic things in common of our anatomy and our cell physiology, but look how different we are as well. These four little letters are what makes us all humans and allow us to be as individual and unique as we are. So pretty darn amazing stuff. Now, I want to show you the three-dimensional structure of DNA. So I have a little film here.
Two DNA strands intertwine to form a double helix. Each strand has a backbone composed of phosphates and sugars to which the bases are attached. The bases form the core of the double helix, while the sugar phosphate backbones are on the outside. The two grooves between the backbones are called the major and minor groove, based on their sizes. Most protein DNA contacts are made in the major groove, because the minor groove is too narrow. backbone is assembled from repeating deoxyribose sugar units that are linked through phosphate groups. Each phosphate carries a negative charge, making the entire DNA backbone highly charged and polar. A cyclic base is attached to each sugar. The bases are planar and extend out perpendicular to the path of the backbone. Pyrimidine bases are composed of one ring, and purine bases of two rings. Adjacent bases are aligned so that their planar rings stack on top of one another. Base stacking contributes significantly to the stability of the double helix.
And these bases are the ATCGs.
In a double helix, each base on one strand is paired to a base on the other strand that lies in the same plane. In these base pairing interactions, guanine always pairs with cytosine and thymine with adenine. A GC pair is stabilized by three hydrogen bonds formed between amino and carbonyl groups that project from the bases. In contrast, an AT pair is stabilized by two hydrogen bonds. The specificity of base pairing, that is, C always pairing with G and A always pairing with T, ensures that the two strands are complementary. This is important for DNA replication and transcription.
And that's what Watson and Crick are oh so famous for, is discovering that structure, that double helix structure. And then look at everything we've discovered since then. So I thought it would be much better to show you three-dimensionally like that, because it's kind of hard to imagine DNA as just a drawing. So with that, now think about that DNA. So here's a diagram of the DNA. Our DNA is packaged into discrete units called chromosomes. So there are long pieces of DNA that are packaged down, and in fact there are 22 what's called autosomes, and then the two sex chromosomes, the X and the Y. So there are, in a human cells, we're all diploid, which means we have two copies of every gene, we have two copies of every chromosome. So we have 46 chromosomes in every cell, in the nucleus of every cell. So there are 46 long pieces of DNA that are packaged down. And so there are two copies of each autosome, and then either two X's for, what does XX mean? Female, what is XY? Male, exactly. So females have two X's and males have XY. And I'm going to show you another little film, because it's really interesting to think about how is all this DNA packaged down. And I just couldn't do it justice without showing it.
In this animation, we'll see the way our DNA is tightly packed up to fit into the nucleus of every cell. The process starts with assembly of a nucleosome, which is formed when eight separate histone protein subunits attach to the DNA molecule. The combined tight loop of DNA and protein is the nucleosome. Six nucleosomes are coiled together, and these then stack on top of each other. The end result is a fiber of packed nucleosomes known as chromatin.
Isn't that an amazing feat? So DNA is packaged around these proteins in a very specific way. And there are the chromosomes range in size from about 50 million base pairs. When we talk about base pairs, we're talking about those A, T's, and C, G's, right? So 50 million of them are in one chromosome, and in other chromosomes they're as big as 250 million base pairs. And the chromosomes, so the DNA, here you can see it sort of wrapped up as it was shown very beautifully in that little video. So typically in a cell, when the cell is kind of doing its function, a liver cell is doing what a liver cell does, a kidney cell is doing its thing, the DNA is decondensed, okay? And we can only see individual chromosomes when it's all condensed down. And it does that condensing right before the cells divide, okay? And I'm going to show you this beautiful image because I just love cell biology and I just can't help but show you this gorgeous image. So this is showing a cell that is undergoing division and its DNA is condensing down and getting ready to segregate into the two daughter cells. So the DNA is in blue, and what you see in green here is what's called microtubules. And these microtubules are protein structures that help the DNA line up and divide so that you have an exact copy of the DNA in each daughter cell. And what you can see here is that the DNA is kind of condensing down more and more, so you can actually see these discrete units in a microscope. And this in this phase called metaphase. So this process of the DNA condensing and dividing is called mitosis. And there are all these separate stages. And this phase, metaphase, is when they are maximally condensed. So when we want to look at chromosomes under the microscope, we harvest cells. We take cells and grow them up. And we treat them with a drug that will stop them right here. So we have a whole collection of cells that are in metaphase. So we can actually look at those chromosomes. And we can stain those chromosomes in a way that creates these banding patterns. So if we look at the chromosomes from a single cell, this is just some schmutz over here. This is the chromosomes from a single cell. And cytogeneticists spend a lot of time looking at chromosomes and are very good at identifying what each one is. And so they can cut them out and line them up. Or now we use very sophisticated software to do a lot of this. But you can identify, we'll look a bit more at the method of doing this next week. But here's actually a chromosome 7 who's upside down, and it looks like a French guy wearing a beret and a striped shirt. And over here is an X chromosome that's upside down, and as I learned, it looks like a girl in a bikini. You can see the stripe there and stripe there. So there are different ways of learning which chromosome is which. And then we cut them out and line them up from the largest to the smallest. Here's the two copies of chromosome 1. Remember, we're diploid, so we have two copies of all the chromosomes. Chromosome 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 21 and 22, and then followed by the sex chromosomes. And in this case, what sex is this individual? Male. It has an X and a Y chromosome. Okay. Another beautiful thing to look at, I just love looking at chromosomes, if you can tell, is a spectral karyotype. And this is some newer technology that's used using fluorescent probes that hybridize or bind to the DNA on the chromosomes. And using very sophisticated fluorescent microscopy, we can see all the different chromosomes in different colors. And this is a great way to look at abnormalities of different chromosomes. All right, so we talked about chromosomes. Now, what is a gene? So, would somebody like to give a definition of a gene? One of our students? Go ahead. A unit that produces a specific protein. Exactly. So, gene is a piece of DNA, if you will, that encodes a protein. Yes. How do you tell the start of the gene and the end of the gene? There are specific sequences that say this is where the protein coding region starts. There are certain sequences that the machinery that translates the DNA into RNA and then into protein, we're not going to go through all of that today, but in that process, there are certain sequences that the little biomachines, if you will, bind to, recognize and bind to it to make the protein. So there are certain sequences that said start here and stop here. The regions that says start here is the same for every... The regions that says start and stop are the same. There are a couple different ones that say stop, but there's the same one that says start for every gene. Yes. So here I'm showing a region that's a gene, and there are... Within a gene, there are exons and introns. What is an exon? So when the students want to say what an exon is? Yeah. So, in fact, does anybody else, did somebody want to say what an intron is? Hold that thought. Did I see a hand? Yeah, go ahead. you take out the intron. So what you said is just the opposite. And I know it's very confusing because it's called exon. So you think that that would be the one that's excised, but
you use that exon and you take out the intron.
Right. So when a gene is composed of exons and introns, but when it comes, the actual protein coding region is all of the exons. So in fact, when this is transcribed into RNA, and then it is manipulated and spliced down so that all the exons come together, and all those exons together actually encode a protein. So you might say, why are the introns there? Well, they have an important role in regulating genes and in other things we'll talk a bit about, but they have other roles that we are still finding out what they do. So, and in addition to encoding for specific proteins, there are also functional RNAs that have been discovered over the past decade. A lot of new information has come out in the last decade even. Now, each gene has a specific location or a specific address on a particular chromosome. Okay, so a gene that encodes, fibrin, the protein fibrin, that has a specific location on a specific chromosome, and everybody has that gene in that particular chromosome. So it's just like your street address for a house. Yes? Its sequence is in the same place in everybody's genome. Okay? Exactly. Now, there are different versions of genes, and different versions of genes are called alleles. And what do I mean by different versions of genes? Well, we have some little different sequences, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes when we talk about genetic variation. So there might be within this population, might have for a particular gene, like I said, fibrin or whatever your favorite protein is, that gene might exist in a couple different flavors in the population. And they might be normal variants, or there might be one that is mutated that leads to a disease. Okay, so in this case, what I'm showing here, we'll go through a little of the terminology. So we have, this is an illustration of chromosome. It looks kind of like a number 2 chromosome, I'll say. So these are the two copies of the number 2 chromosome, and they're called homologous chromosomes, the two copies of the same chromosome. And down here, we're looking at this one particular gene there, and its location, its street address is called its locus. Okay, the locus is the specific address of that gene on the chromosome. And here I'm showing two that are the same, and that's called homozygous. And when you have two different versions or two different alleles, one on one chromosome and one on its homologous chromosome, that is called heterozygous. And you can be heterozygous for two different versions of normal genes, or you can be heterozygous and one of them can be a mutation that is detrimental. And you can also have what is called compound heterozygous, is when you have two different mutations. And this is very common in diseases like, for example, cystic fibrosis. There are many different mutations out there. So it is very common for people with cystic fibrosis to have two different mutations. Okay, so we've talked about the different genes, different alleles. So if we look at each of us and we look at our own collection of all our specific alleles and put those together, that is our genotype. So our genotype is the alleles that are present at the specific locus within our genome, okay? And how our own specific genotype plays out physically is the phenotype, okay? So that's the physical manifestation or the physical expression of our own genotype. And the phenotype, I want to point out again here, as I mentioned early on, the phenotype is really a combination of the genotype and environment. All right, the environment is always playing a role on how the gene is expressed. So we've talked about genes, we've talked about chromosomes, what about genomes? So who'd like to define a genome? What is a genome? The complete genetic makeup. Yes. So the genome is all of our DNA, okay? Now, it's not only the DNA in our nucleus, it's also the DNA in our mitochondria. Did you know our mitochondria have DNA? Yeah. So it's the DNA in our mitochondria as well. So all of that DNA is our human genome, okay? The genes and the non-coding regions, all of it. Now, I say every cell in our body contains a complete copy of the human genome. For extra credit, who knows a cell in our body that does not have DNA? Red blood cells. Who said that? Excellent. Good job. Extra credit points. Yes, our red blood cells, as they go through the maturation process to become a circulating red blood cell, it loses its nucleus. So our red blood cells do not have any DNA. Now, what's important to think about is, so our genome is all of our genes and the non-coding regions, all of our DNA, but not all of those genes are turned on in every cell. So what makes a liver cell, a kidney cell, an eye cell? Well, there are different patterns of gene expression. So some genes are turned on in certain cells, and other genes are turned on in other cells. And there are some genes that are turned on in all cells that are just required for the basic cell physiology. But that is what allows each cell to carry on its own function. So how big is this? Is our human genome? 3 billion base pairs. 3 billion base pairs, so AT and CGs. Within those 3 billion base pairs, there's less than 20,000 genes, which is actually a lot fewer than what was originally thought. I mean, way back before the Human Genome Project began in the early 90s and before, it was thought that we must have at least 100,000 genes. Looking at what, you know, what other organisms, and we thought we must have so many more genes than any other species because we are so much more evolved than them. Well, guess what? That's not true. We only have about 20,000 genes. It's not that many, but it's how they all come together. And I'm going to talk about some other interesting things that plays out that allows us to have a lot of flexibility within our human genome. So we think about how big this is, just to give you a little context, because I think this is kind of cool to think about. So our human genome, if you were to take all the DNA from all the chromosomes and line it all up, it's about 6 feet, about 2 meters or 6 feet, just over 6 feet of DNA, taller than me, in every cell of your body. Every single cell has more than 6 feet of DNA wrapped up. Pretty amazing, huh? Now, another way to think about this is if you were to take all the letters of the human genome and write them in a font size that would be in a textbook with like a millimeter in between each letter, and to line that all up, that comes out to about 3,200 kilometers, or about 2,000 miles, which is enough to extend across Central Africa, which is where humans originated, interestingly. And if we take the DNA from all of our cells, our about 100 trillion cells in our body, you take all the DNA, line it all up, 113 billion miles of DNA. And just to give you context, that's enough to go from the Earth to the Sun, not the Moon, to the Sun, and back 610 times. That's a lot of DNA we have in our bodies, isn't it? It's really quite amazing stuff. Okay, so I've thrown a lot at you, so I just want to take a minute to recap and review what we've talked about. So we have our DNA here is composed of the four nucleotides of adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, and A always binds with T, and C always binds with G. And a gene is a protein coding region, and the DNA is wrapped up and compacted down into chromosomes, discrete units. And we have 46 chromosomes in our human cells, in all of our somatic cells. Does anybody know what somatic cell is? I'll give you the flip one. Yes. It's in the body. And what were you going to say? Sorry? I heard somebody else?
Not a germ cell.
Not a germ cell. Exactly. So it's all the cells of our body that are not our eggs or our sperm are all the somatic cells. All right, so eggs and sperm are a little bit different. They are not diploid, they're haploid because they're going to join to create another human being. So we have 46 chromosomes in all our somatic cells, about 2 meters of DNA, 3 billion base pairs, and approximately 20,000 genes. So with those 20,000 genes and all the rest of that 3 billion base pairs of DNA, it's interesting to think about how it's structured or how it's organized. And actually, the human genome is organized kind of similar to how our civilizations are organized on our planet. So there are some regions, just like our dense urban centers, there are certain regions in the genome that are gene-rich, that have a lot of coding regions, that are making a lot of proteins. And there are other regions that are like our vast deserts, that are non-coding. Now, a while ago, this used to be called junk DNA, and we know now it is not junk. It's very important stuff, and I'll talk a bit about that in just a moment. It's kind of called the dark matter of the genome. But it makes sense how the genome is organized in this way because it's very efficient. So if all the protein coding regions are in a similar place, then it can be very efficient to make those proteins. So there's a lot of... It makes a lot of sense for efficiencies within the cell, the way our genome is organized. Now, in these protein, the regions that are gene-rich, that is only about 1 to 2% of our genome. So those 20,000 genes, that's only 1 to 2% of our genome. The vast majority of our genome, 99 to 98% of our genome, is non-coding. So what's it all doing? I'll tell you in just a moment. So this is the part that's actually what we call transcribed, making protein. And this part is involved in things like maintaining chromosome structure and several other things that I will tell you about in just a moment. So just to give you a little historical context, back in 1990, that's when the Human Genome Project began. And it was planned to be a 15-year project. And in fact, it came in early. How often does a big project, like a huge project, end early? Pretty rare, right? What happened was the technology went forward so quickly. It was just amazing. People had no idea that the technology could advance as quickly as it did. And that allowed the genome to be sequenced faster and faster and in different ways. So in 10 years, by 2000, 2001, there was a working draft, if you will, of the complete human genome. And by 2006 was the final papers were published. But what this gave us, the Human Genome Project, gave us a sequence of the human genome that's like an average sequence. Okay? But after that, since we had that sequence, and then with technology increasing, it gave us the ability to sequence many different people's genomes. So it took, 10 years to get to this place? Now within... weeks or a very short period of time, you can have a whole genome sequenced. So the technology is just phenomenal. And now that we've been looking at the human genome from many different people, there's two very important things that have come out of that. The one is realizing how much variation there is within the human genome. That was definitely not appreciated before and was a big surprise when scientists started looking at individual genomes. And the other thing was looking at that dark matter, the non-coding regions, and finding out that, heck, that's really important stuff, and it has some important roles. And that information actually just came out last year. Last summer, this was a big splash. I don't know if any of you guys heard this. It was in the news. It was kind of like the next big thing after the human genome was released. There was this ENCODE project, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, or ENCODE. And so what they were looking at was all that non-coding DNA, what is it doing? What are looking at all the elements of the DNA? And so they wanted to characterize that. And they found out that this dark matter, the non-coding regions, is much more active than was thought. And in fact, it does things like it controls chromatin structure. Chromatin is the proteins that the DNA wraps around the protein, so that together the protein and DNA is called chromatin. And it regulates transcription. It has a lot to do with turning on and off genes like a dimmer switch does. So it's not just on-off, but like different gradations. So it's kind of fine-tuning our gene expression, if you will. And this has a huge significance, a very important significance for human disease. Okay, so now I want to look at some of that variation that I just talked about. Yes? How do you know which genes it turns on and turns off? So there are, this was a 5-year project, and there are several journals full of papers describing this. And so a lot of research goes into the minutiae of trying to find out what gene is turned on and off by the different elements. But it's there are many different types of experiments that you can do that, basically. And a lot of it's not known yet what genes are turned on and off by those elements. Some of them it has been determined.
What about the last one from the transcription
regulators? Oh, sorry. So epigenetic regulation. So epigenetics is another fascinating field within genetics. Does anybody know what epigenetic means? Yes.
Study the environment.
Yes, so the effect of the environment on turning genes on and off. And in fact, we have what's kind of called an epigenome. So we have the DNA, which is the nucleotides, and then layered on top of that, there are some proteins and other things that affect gene expression, but they can turn on and off, and it can come on and off at different times during our life cycle. And there are different environmental factors and other things that affect these epigenetic phenomena. So one thing, one example of an epigenetic phenomenon is called methylation. So this is a chemical, methyl group that binds to the region before the gene. And when it binds to that region, it turns off expression. And so during development, there are certain genes that are controlled in this way that are turned off, and then later in development, they're turned on, or vice versa. So epigenetics is basically something that's layered on top of the DNA, like different chemical, like methylation groups, or different ways of histone, acetylating histone, so different chemical structures that affect gene expression. Okay, and a very important thing about epigenetics is that it's reversible. So the DNA sequence is what it is, but the epigenetics aspects that kind of sit on top of it can come on and off to affect gene expression. Yes?
The Lee Press is just reporting recently that grandparents' behavior can be passed on to their grandchildren, specifically smoking grandmothers to asthma and grandchildren.
Right. So the question is about how in the lay press that they've been talking about how certain behaviors can be transmitted from generations down. So things like smoking. And what was the other one you mentioned?
Smoking the grandparent caused asthma.
Oh, the smoking in the grandparent caused asthma in the grandchild. So very interesting, and I think so. I don't know all the details of that, but there are so to some, yes, there is. That is epigenetics is thought to play a role in that, as well. The other part that I thought you were getting at that's a little bit different is that behaviors are also very often encoded genetically. So you know, even risk-taking behaviors or more dependency behaviors. It can be a genetic component to that as well. Good questions. Okay, so now let's look at this genetic variation that I'm talking about. So we're all alike, but we are not the same. Thank goodness, right? So our human genome is 3 billion base pairs, and that original sequence that was released is the average sequence. And once they start to look at individual sequences, we found that, in fact, there's no one human genome, but there are 6 billion different human genomes. We all have our own unique human genome. Now, having said that, we're still about 99% identical in our human genome. But even that 1.1 to 1%, that means that there are about 3.5 million differences in our genomes between us, okay? And these differences can be at the single nucleotide level, those ATCG at a single base level, or they can involve chunks of DNA, which is really fascinating. This is something that has just come out in the last 5 to 10 years, even less than 10 years, really like the past 5 to 8 years, the idea of the types of variation within our human genome. Question back there?
Yes. From the 6 billion human genomes, does that mean that every single person except for identical twins has their own genome?
Yes. So what I'm saying, the question was, does the 6 billion human genomes mean that everybody has their own unique genome except for identical twins that have the same? Yes. And that's exactly what I'm saying. Like there are differences between every individual, which, I mean, you look around, right? We are all similar in that we're human, but we are all unique, and our genomes are as well. Yes. Now, some of these variants as we will see, some of them are very rare and some of them are quite common, okay? And the ones that are common, as you would expect, are things that are a bit more benign or things that just give us our physical characteristics, the differences between us. And the ones that are more rare, as you might suspect, might be those that are a bit, that have a more detrimental effect. Okay, so you don't see those as much because they might be selected against during evolution, where other things might not be, there might not be a selective pressure against other things, so they become more common in our population. So down here I have that each individual is heterozygous at about 20% of loci. So remember when we talked about different alleles? So each of us, at about 20% of our genes, have two different versions of that gene. That's what I mean. Okay, so that gets at some of this level of difference between our human genomes. Okay, so just giving an example, you can have variation, as I said, at a single nucleotide level. So if this particular location in 75% of people is a C, and another, and in 25% of people might be a T. Okay, so there's differences at the single nucleotide level, as well as small regions of DNA, as well as big chunks of DNA. Where does all this genetic variation come from? The answer is mutation. Okay, during evolution, mutation is technically any change in the DNA sequence. And nature likes to play a lot of experiments, and that's why we have a lot of variation in our genome. And some things work and some things don't, and this is how we got to be where we are, right? So where does this mutation come from? So there are some errors that occur naturally within our cells. When the DNA is being replicated, that machinery sometimes puts in an incorrect nucleotide. So that can account for about hundreds, actually, of new mutations every time the human genome is replicated. There are also errors that occur during what's called homologous recombination. This is during gametogenesis, or when the egg and the sperm are being formed. The DNA recombines in particular ways. And sometimes there's some errors that occur, so you can have something that recombines incorrectly. And there are also mutagens, or things that cause mutations, in our environment. So radiation, different chemicals we're exposed to, cigarette smoke, all the things in our environment that can cause base changes or changes in our DNA. So most of the time these are repaired. We have an amazing set of mechanics in our cells that repair most of the these mutations that occur. But sometimes they're not repaired, they slip by, and they're maintained as a mutation. Question?
Yeah, about mutagens. Why is the aging process a mutagen? In other words, I, as a person over 50 having a child, would most likely result in a child having a genetic defect. Why is that?
So he's asking, you were saying, why is the aging process a mutagen, and why would an older person be more likely to have a child with a genetic defect? So the aging process itself is not a mutagen, but what happens is as we age, we collect different mutations, right? So they accumulate over our lifetime, which is why cancer typically develops in older people, right? Because it's an accumulation of mutations over our lifetime. So it's not that the aging process per se is mutagenic, but that we have accumulated things over a lifetime that you are now seeing.
They accumulate everywhere or in a certain area of the gene?
They can accumulate they can accumulate anywhere. Yeah. Yes, one more question.
You indicate 100 new mutations in a life. In what period of time?
You're asking in what period of time do the mutations occur?
100 of them occur.
So this would occur, the mutations in this case is occurring only in dividing cells. So a lot of our cells are no longer dividing. So they're not being affected in this case. But these are, all of our dividing cells are acquiring these mutations. Now, if the mutation is very detrimental, the cell might not survive. It might just die off and you never even know it.
Does it happen in a day, in a week?
Every day. Every day. This is happening in our dividing cells every day. And so most of the time, as I'll show you in a minute, most of the time these changes have no effect. It's just benign. It has no effect on us at all. And it's only the rare ones that actually do have an effect. And remember that only 1% of our genome encodes for proteins, right? And the vast majority does not. Now, it has a function, the rest of it, but there's a lot of DNA that can absorb these changes without having a detrimental effect on our health. Okay? All right. And we'll come back to some more questions afterwards if we can, okay? All right. So coming, I actually want to continue on that thought. So if we think about the consequences of genetic variation, so let's think about the frequency of the variant in the population. So there are those genetic variants that have a direct cause, that directly cause disease, okay? They're in a protein coding region, in a gene that when that gene is disrupted, it leads to a specific disease like cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease. These tend to be rare in the population, but they have a very high impact on health, okay? Then there are those that are involved in multifactorial diseases, right? Remember, multifactorial diseases are those that are due to multiple factors, multiple genes and environmental factors combined, and leading to diseases like diabetes, stroke, hypertension. Now, the variants involved here, each individual variant might not have as big an impact. It's the combination of them that have a larger impact, okay? Now, as we move down the spectrum to the frequency of the population, there are those that are benign phenotypic differences, okay? So our hair color, our skin color, I said the asparagus smell, so you know when you eat asparagus, some people have that smell in your urine and some people don't. There are some differences in an enzyme that breaks down a particular chemical that leads to that smell. Some people have it, some people don't. Doesn't affect our health at all, right? So these are more benign. And so these variants are very common in the population and allow for our individuality. And then there are a lot of variants that have no effect at all, okay? So a lot of these mutations that are happening might have absolutely no effect. And in fact, the majority of them probably have no effect, okay? Now, these are rare mutations, the ones that have the highest impact on health, or detrimental impact, I should say, are the more rare ones. Typically, I should couch that. I don't want to make this too complicated, but in fact, some new studies are showing some interesting things in our human genome about so what is common and what is rare and their impact. But in general, those that have a detrimental effect tend to be more rare, and those that are more common are called polymorphisms. Okay, so those variants that are seen in our genomes, in our population, at more than 1% within the population is considered a polymorphism. So it's pretty frequent, pretty commonly seen. And those that have a high impact that are rare are called, within the medical genetics, we call those mutations. Now, you know, I said that all variation comes from mutation. So mutation is kind of used in a couple ways. Mutation can be a verb that the DNA has been mutated and allows for a change, or we can call it sort of a noun, like that mutation. So just to clarify, like the way that our DNA, the variants arise is from mutations, but then those that are maintained in the population are called polymorphisms. And those that are very rare, that have a high impact and usually cause disease, are called mutations within the medical field, okay? Now, the location of the variant can play an important part in the consequence. So those that are in or near a regulatory region or within a gene itself are more likely to have a high impact. And those are also more rare. And that makes sense because, again, the genes of our genome constitute only 1% of the genome, right? And there's 99%, that is not coding for protein. So if you have a variant in that other region, it does not have the same impact, And those, so the impact is low, and those are the ones that are more common. Okay, does that make sense? So when I talk about variants, let's look at a couple examples here. So I said that you can have a single nucleotide change. Now, if that single nucleotide is in an intron or in a non-coding region, it might not have any effect, or it could have a significant effect. So if we look at this example here, beer, and we just change this E to an A, suddenly it's bear. So I'd like to have a beer. That sounds good to me right now. I'd like to have a beer. But I'd like to have a bear. That's something very different. Okay, so sometimes these changes can make a big difference, or other times they might not make a difference at all. So looking at this, here's a little diagram of DNA to show you what I'm looking at. Here's a CG pair that perhaps in 80% of people you see the CG pair, and 20% you see this TA pair. So these are common variants and are called single nucleotide polymorphisms. So again, polymorphisms are those variants that are common in our population. And those that are just at a single nucleotide level are called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms. Now, sometimes these SNPs, if they are in a protein coding region, sometimes they are silent, which means that they are not changing the encoded amino acid. They are not changing the protein. Or sometimes they are what's called non-synonymous. They might change the amino acid, in which case they can have some effect. Okay. So how different are we? Well, as far as SNPs go, they actually account for a majority of our genetic variation. They account for about 90% of the variation. They occur about every 300 to 1,000 base pairs along our genome. There's a difference between us in the population. On average, there's about 3 to 10 million different single nucleotide changes between two people, in any two people. So whether they be two people from, you know, within this room or two people from around the world. In addition to single nucleotide changes, there can be deletions and duplications of either a single nucleotide or a couple nucleotides or bigger chunks. So just to give you an example here, there's this sentence, I like to swim in the ocean, but I do not like to swim in the pool. Now, if you take this orange region and you delete it, that changes the sense of this sentence quite a bit, because now it says, I like to swim in the pool. And if you duplicate that region, it also changes the sense of that sentence. Now it says, I like to swim in the ocean, but I do not like to swim in the ocean, but I do not like to swim in the pool. So there are sometimes that deletions and duplications can have a big effect, and sometimes, again, depending where they are in the genome, they might not have any effect. And they can be small or they can be large. And when they are large, they're called copy number variants. So copy number variants are large chunks of DNA. And this is something that just blew scientists away when we discovered this, that large chunks of DNA can be repeated in different places of the genome. What? And it's normal. It is our normal genetic variation. The consequences of this vary. Many of these changes are completely benign or neutral. They don't have any detrimental effect on our health. And there are those that affect gene dosage, which means that, you know, when we talked about how genes can be turned on or off, or there can be a dimmer switch. So some of these affect gene dosage. So there might be more protein made or less protein made, and that can cause a problem. Question?
Second bullet.
You say, what did you say about the...
That second bullet right there.
Can,
that would be an example of mutation in intron variant.
So you can have a... So the question is, would a mutation within an intron or a variant within an intron cause gene dosage effect? So there could be a change within an intron that does affect the protein. It might actually cause truncation of the protein. It might cause different, what's called splicing, so it could lead to defects in the protein, even if it's within the intron. What more likely leads to gene dosage effect is with when it's outside the gene in the what's called the regulatory region that turns the whole gene on or off. Okay, and there are regions that are called promoters that are outside the gene, and that's the regions where we're talking about before, where the little motors sit down to to read the DNA, if you will. So in those regions, when there are mutations, that affects gene dosage very often. Okay. So another example of thinking about copy number variants and those that might have an effect versus not. So in this example of copy number variants in cake mix. So if the recipe calls for one egg, and then you have one egg, 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 well, some cakes might be okay with more than one egg. It might not have that much difference. But other cakes, it's very critical that you have just one egg for it to come out just right. Okay, so certain regions can be copied. There can be variations in the copy number, and it's okay. In other regions, it has a big effect. Okay, so when talking about copy number variants and structural variation, I just wanted to give you a little flavor of what this looks like. So this is an illustration of a chromosome here, and what we're looking at here are different loci. So these might be genes, or they might just be sections within the DNA that are not coding, okay? Can be either way. So, for example, if normally there is an A, B, C, D, these four loci together. Now, there might be some regions that are, this C is duplicated. So this is called, this is when I said you can have a duplication in the genome. Or there might be, in this case, there are three copies of this C. So you might have two copies, you might have three copies, and they might even be in different places. And in this case, there's a very complex rearrangement where there are multiple copies of this D, and then there's a C, and then a D, and then a C. So this just gives a flavor of the extent of the variability within our human genomes. Yes?
Do we know where these come from?
Do we know where these come from?
Right. What causes them?
Yes, so where does this come from? This comes from the things that I talked about early on that lead to mutation. So sometimes there are things that occur from DNA replication, et cetera, and these might occur during the homologous recombination, which is an important thing that happens to produce our eggs and our sperm. And there are other things that might cause genomic rearrangements. There are other times when there are recombinations that occur. Yes. Okay. So this, I don't worry about the details of this, but I just wanted to give you a sense of how much variation there is in our human genome. So this is a diagram of all the chromosomes, and these dots next to them here are indications of different places in the genome where there are variations from person to person. Now, not everybody has, the same variation, but these are all different regions throughout the genome where variations are seen. So there is quite a lot of variation, and thank goodness for that, because we are all individual, and we certainly need that in our population. So with that, are there, let me first go through our keywords, then we can go through some questions. I think there were some other people that had questions that we didn't get to. So keywords, we talked about DNA. So what is DNA? It's the sequence of the four nucleotides, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And gene, so what is a gene? Shout it out. A sequence that encodes protein. Yes. Allele, what is an allele? A different version of a gene. Yes, a different version of a gene. A chromosome. So a chromosome is a segment of DNA, right? And how many chromosomes do we have in our cells? 46, exactly. The genome. The genome is all of our DNA, both on our nucleus and in the mitochondria. The genotype is the collection of all the alleles of our particular genomes. That's our genotype. And how that plays out in a physical manifestation in combination with environmental effects is our phenotype. And a mutation is typically considered as a rare variant that has a detrimental effect on health. And polymorphisms are those variants that are common in the population. And some polymorphisms might have a detrimental effect or a benign effect, and some might have no effect at all. It's the full spectrum. Yes, question?
So if there's a rare mutation, but it isn't
Sorry, say that again.
If it's rare, but it's not, it doesn't have a negative effect.
Yes.
Mutation.
So if it's rare, but it doesn't have an effect, so I kind of made two very broad categories. There are certainly things that are rare that have no, that might not have any effect. The point is that if there is a rare, a mutation occurs, any new mutation, and actually you bring up an interesting point because they found a lot of rare variants that might be more benign, and what that indicates is that we are acquiring a lot of mutations within our genome all the time. Those that do not have a detrimental effect are maintained and end up becoming common. So over generations, many, many generations, they become polymorphisms. Okay? Good question. Yes? Are there any genes that do not have alleles, that do not have different alleles? I can't really say for sure. I don't know of an example for sure of a gene that does not have a different version. I think that it's more common for there to be different alleles. Now, some genes, there might be only a couple alleles, and others, there might be many different alleles. Or, and it depends if we're talking about the normal gene, normal alleles, versus those that are involved with disease. So, for example, with using cystic fibrosis as an example, most people with cystic fibrosis in the Caucasian population, there is one mutation that accounts for many of them, but there are also hundreds of other different mutations. So there are hundreds of other alleles of that particular gene that lead to the disease. Okay? Yes?
Use the term nucleotide just to give a brief definition.
Yes, sorry, I should have defined that earlier. So a nucleotide is the basic structure of the DNA, the building blocks of the DNA. And what a nucleotide is the base, which is the adenine, thymine, guanine, or cytosine, that base. And there's a ribose sugar and the phosphate group. So those things together make this subunit, the building block of the DNA. Okay, so the whole nucleotide consists of the base and this other structure of the sugar and the phosphate group. That's what the nucleotide is. Okay, yes?
Can you talk about where things like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell, for instance, which may have had a functional use during epidemics like cholera and malaria, is that one of the reasons they're still maintaining the population?
So a very interesting question. So the question is for, I'm trying to think of another example with malaria. So there are certain disorders like sickle cell. Is that what did you say sickle cell? Yeah, so sickle cell is actually a great example. So something like sickle cell disease and malaria. So sickle cell disease, although it's a very devastating disorder, it actually, the people with sickle cell do not come down with malaria. So it can be beneficial within certain geographic areas where there is a high malarial incident. And in fact, you're exactly right that within those areas, you see a higher incidence of sickle cell because it is protective. So it is maintained in those regions because it has a protective effect. Yes, absolutely. That's a very interesting question. So yeah, there is kind of that fine line. And there are, in fact, disease-causing mutations that are, in fact, polymorphisms because they are common, particularly in a certain geographic population, and that's a great example. Yeah. Yes?
If the genome includes a mitochondrial DNA, I've heard that identical twins are not identical because they get different mitochondrial DNA. So if that's right, how much variation can you account for? How much variation is that mitochondrial DNA?
Okay, so the question is about identical twins, and they have the identical nuclear genome, but the genome also includes the mitochondrial genome. And so the mitochondria, so it is true that the mitochondria is all inherited from the mother, from the egg. So identical twins come from the same egg, but when it splits off, it might have different subsets of mitochondria. So that's a very good point. So there is some differences in the mitochondria. Most of the mitochondrial genome encodes for genes that are involved in within the mitochondria of making ATP, of making energy for the cell. So a lot of the differences might be within that. So if you're asking how... Pardon?
I wonder if you ever see it. I
mean, would you see it? Would you see the difference? Yeah. You know, I don't have a good answer to that. I don't know if that's been really studied a lot to know, like, what the extent of the differences are. But that's a very interesting question. Yeah. Yes?
In your slide entitled The ABCs of Genes and Genome, you have a biological correlate for a letter, word, and chapters in a book, but you have nothing for a sentence. Did I miss something?
Well, I mean, you can kind of use the analogy in different ways. So I was using the letters are like the nucleotides, if you will, or the bases. And a gene is like a word when they come together. Now, in this case, you're saying I didn't have anything for a sentence because we're saying more the chapters are the chromosomes. So a sentence could be...
Could it be functional?
In fact, I would say that what a sentence is more like the gene and all of its regulatory regions, and maybe that part of the NARC matter that's actually affecting the expression of that gene, that might kind of, you can think of that as sort of the sentence, you know, sort of the surrounding regions that affect the expression of that particular gene.
Say functional.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
The error check that you had mentioned, since we are constantly having mutations every day, how does this error checking function know what's correct? How does it know that, okay, this is wrong and this is right?
Right. Yes. Okay, so the question is about the error checking system and how does it know what is the right sequence, basically, and to maintain it. So that's actually a really great question, and it's quite fascinating. So a lot of the work had been done to figure that out, those systems out, in bacteria. And so it's known in bacteria how it does it, and it's not completely clear. We think we know how it happens in human cells, but it's not completely clear. But basically, when DNA is replicated, one of the strands is methylated or is marked in some way. So it's known what the original strand is and what the copied strand, what the new strand is. So when the machinery goes by to check it, it can tell whether it is the original strand or it's the newly synthesized strand. And when it sees a difference on the new strand versus the original strand, it cuts it out and puts in, it copies it off of the original strand and puts in the base that pairs with the base in the original strand. So there are ways that it actually marks the difference of the new strand versus the original strand.
So in diseases such as cancer, you've got cells that are perfect, continue to be checked off as this is okay by this error check. There's obviously some sort of maybe mutation here.
Bingo. It's a very, very astute of you. In fact, in cancer, so the question was, what happens in cancer? And in fact, very often in cancer, there is a loss or a defect in these DNA repair mechanisms. So not only do you start with some mutations, but then you lose the ability to repair, and then you acquire a whole bunch more mutations. So it kind of sets you on this path to acquire more and more mutations. Exactly. And there are, I won't go into all the details now, but there are several different types of DNA repair mechanisms that each are very specific for the type of change that they repair. And there are certain ones that are involved in different types of cancer, too. Yes. Yes.
When cells are dividing...
Right. Right. So this is the questions about recombination that occurs, normal recombination. This comes back to like the basic Mendelian principles that allow for independent assortment of our genes. And so, in fact, there is just like the DNA repair machinery looks for, you know, very specific things. When the DNA recombines, there are sequences that it looks for that are what's called homologous. So they're similar and they can pair, and so they will recombine in that region. So there are sort of points along the human genome that say, okay, here are places that we can hook up. Sometimes there's an error, and it thinks it's this one, but it's actually that one, right? So, and that's when an error can occur. So there are times where there are very similar sequences, and it misreads it. It thinks that it's the one it's supposed to pair to, but it's a different one. So that's when an error can occur. Now, there are also mechanisms that can try to monitor for that, but sometimes that can occur as well. Yes, that is when an error occurs, that's how it occurs, that there's a mispairing.
Recombination, new word for what I learned is crossovers.
Yes, it's the same. Yes, crossovers, recombination, yes. Yes. Yeah. Do you have your hand up? Yeah.
Referring back to the error checking mechanism that's failed, are there therapies being developed possibly? Introduce it, correct it, error check it. In other words, okay, these are malignant liver cells. Is there some way to maybe take healthy liver cells and maybe, for lack of a better word, teach the error check and says, this is correct?
Do you want a job at Genentech?
Yeah.
I mean, this is exactly. So there are. It would be wonderful. So the question is about with cancer therapies, and is there a way to go in and repair? If there's a defect in the repair, can you go in and fix that? So this is one of the areas for targets of targeted therapies. That's one of the areas. Yeah, I don't want to say too much because it's kind of a complicated area, but yes, that is definitely an area. If we could figure out how to repair some of the defects in the repair systems or to somehow reduce the number of new mutations, it would be great. Yeah. But we're not there yet. Yes?
In terms of homologous recombination, somebody was talking about the asthma being passed on from grandparents to grandchildren. I also read a study about diabetes. Famine or surplus having effects on the effects from grandparents and diabetes in future generations. Would that mutation or error occur in all of this in combination?
I think what you're referring to comes back to the epigenetics. There are some epigenetics, some things that are laid down in the egg and the sperm that are inherited in future generations.
So would you say there was an epigenetic effect that, I mean, can those two things exist? Can there be an epigenetic effect on homologous recombination that causes homologous recombination?
So those are different things. Those are two different things. Could they both occur? They can certainly both occur, but they are two different things. So epigenetics, you can think of more as something that layers on top of the genome and kind of controls the expression, but it's a little bit separate than the actual genome. And the other, the recombination occurs within the DNA itself. Okay. Okay. Oh, yep. A couple more questions. Yes.
Your slide on genetic variation, you talked about mutations and kind of environmental influences and so forth and so on. It makes me wonder about evolution. And so is there research being done about what kind of triggers might have caused, as a result of stress or hunger or other things, us to evolve more than where we are today?
Yes. So the question is about research in evolutionary biology, really. And there certainly is a lot of research in that area. It's not my field, so I can't say a lot of specifics about that, but certainly there is a lot of research going on and has been over, you know, over the years, of looking at these different effects and looking at what those effects of, like, famine or et cetera might have on the genome, might be on an epigenetic level. There might be other things that are going on, but certainly, yes. Yeah. Yes.
In your scale for disease that were driven by genetic mutations versus environmental factors, how does that, how do you plot disease on that scale? If you don't, maybe there are mutations that you're not aware of and you have not correlated with the disease yet. Maybe you're aware of one or two mutations that can drive disease, but there may be kind of unknown mutations that drive the disease. Does that automatically plot you in kind of the environmental factors sliding scale until you find those genetic determinants of disease, or is it more kind of weird?
Right. So the question is about, so these are more, you're talking about mutations that are leading to disease that have not yet been identified. Is right. that what you're getting at?
Yes, exactly. You've plotted some diseases that are driven by mutations and some diseases that are driven by environmental factors.
Yes.
And could it be that some of the diseases that you've plotted are driven by environmental factors or just because you don't know about the actual genetic mutations yet that are linked to that disease?
Right. So the question is sort of the genetics versus environmental impact of these of as yet unknown mutations. So to take a step back, we're actually going to talk a bit more next week about inheritance patterns that will clarify a little bit of this as well. So when you see when there is a disease within a family, and you can see that by looking at the inheritance of that disease through generations, that there is a clear genetic component to it, then you might not. So there are many diseases that we still that is clearly in what we call a Mendelian, or it's due to a single gene based on the way that it is inherited through generations, but the actual gene and the defect have not yet been identified. So in those cases, it's still considered in that rare disease-causing, you know, category, even though the gene, the specific gene and specific mutation have not yet been identified, and that is. That is clarified by looking at families that are affected with the diseases to see what the pattern of inheritance is. And then there are other diseases that are very common in the population that you see some families have more of that disease than another, so you know that there's a clear genetic input, but then also environment plays a role. And the environment, you can see even within a family, there might be variations in how severe that disease is. And there are a lot of ways that you look for the genetic contribution to disease, looking at things like twin studies, adoption studies. There are a lot of ways to look at if a particular disease has a genetic component or not. Okay. Yes, so actually, let me just take a break here. I think I've heard some rustling. So if some people would like to leave, why don't you, you can go ahead. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.